Spiked is free, and it always will be. There's no paywall, no subscriptions. We want to reach as many people as possible. But to do that, we need your help. If you support the work that we do here, why not become a regular donor? Just £5 per month will keep us going, even in these uncertain times. To do so, just go to spiked-online.com and click on the big red donate button. Whatever you can give is greatly appreciated, especially given all that's going on in the world. Thanks so much, and now on with the show. Welcome to Last Orders, a Spiked podcast. I'm Tom Slater, and this is the show where myself and Chris Snowden usually discuss all the latest nanny state news with the help of an invited guest. But for the moment, we're only really talking about one thing, the coronavirus crisis. In this episode, we're joined by the great Matt Ridley to discuss how innovation can get us out of this mess, whether the UK's lockdown will ever end, and the worrying rise of corona prohibition. Hello and welcome to Last Orders, a Spiked podcast. My name's Tom Slater, and today, as ever, I'm joined by Chris Snowden from the Institute of Economic Affairs. Hello, Chris. How are you doing?
Hello, Tom. I'm not bad, thanks.
And today we're absolutely delighted to be joined by Matt Ridley. Matt will be known to many of our listeners as a prolific writer and journalist on science and politics, a Conservative peer in the House of Lords as well, and the author of a number of seminal books, including 2010's The Rational Optimist and a fantastic new book called How Innovation Works, which we're going to be talking about today. Matt, thanks so much for joining us today.
Great to be on the show with you. Thanks for having me.
So, Matt, to kick things off, I want to dive into your book. I imagine having a book come out in the midst of a pandemic has been difficult, but at least the kind of theme of innovation and how we can use, you know, human ingenuity to tackle this big problem that we're faced with, at least it makes the themes that you're touching on very, very pressing. But just to kick things off, could you tell us a little bit about what your kind of core thesis is with the book, what point you're trying to get across?
Yeah, the core thesis of my book is that innovation is an extremely important process. It's the main reason we're all prosperous and successful compared with our ancestors, but it's somewhat mysterious. When you ask people how it works, where it comes from, why it happens to us and not to rabbits or rocks, how you stimulate it, how you drive policies that create it, and exactly how it fits into economic theories, you come up fairly empty, actually. There's not actually that much intelligent thinking out there about it. So my attempt was to be very empirical about it, tell a lot of stories about how innovation happens, stories of search engines and steam engines, stories of vaping and vaccines, and from those pull out various themes that seem to be common to innovations throughout the ages. And as you say, it's innovation that'll get us out of this pandemic, whether it's a new vaccine or a new diagnostic test or a new antiviral or new ways of working so that we don't have to come within 2 meters of each other ever again.
And before we get onto the pandemic and how innovation might get us out of this, one of the themes that you touch on is the difference between invention and innovation. And I know you talk about this particularly in relation to Edison. I was just wondering if you could say a little bit about that.
The way I see it is invention is coming up with a new prototype that might or might not be practical. Innovation is turning that into a reliable, affordable, and available thing that everybody can have access to and that's actually useful to people. And that is a much harder process than generally credited. So the inventor is often really annoyed that he doesn't get more money for his invention. And he thinks that the downstream people who've turned it into a practical product get too much credit and too much reward. And he's often wrong. There's a nice story that Charles Townes, the inventor of the laser, used to tell about a beaver and a rabbit looking at the Hoover Dam. And the beaver is saying, "No, I didn't build it, but it's based on an idea of mine." And that's the way a lot of, you know, scientists see what happens to their ideas. Edison is key here because Edison wouldn't have called himself an innovator. He'd have called himself an inventor because the word wasn't around much in those days. But actually, he was in the business of innovation. He was in the business of taking ideas that other people had had and turning them into really practical things that worked. And so the classic example is the light bulb. 5,000 different plants he tried before he found the Japanese bamboo fiber that worked best for the filament of his first light bulb. The other people who'd invented light bulbs, and there were 20 of them in different countries, never did that much hard work of trial and error. And it was Edison who famously said, invention is 1% inspiration and 99% perspiration.
And moving to the pandemic and the question of how we're going to tackle this, because I know that one of the themes you hit on is actually how in so many areas of innovation, things have kind of stalled, have not necessarily progressed. And I know that you've even raised this point in relation to something like vaccines. So how kind of confident can we be that we can rise to the challenge of this when it feels that in some areas, innovation has kind of stalled in those kinds of areas?
Yeah, I mean, I think I was shocked by how little vaccine development, I should say, has changed over the decades. Once I sort of twigged that it's going to at least 18 months to produce a vaccine for this thing, well, I tell the story about the whooping cough vaccine, which was developed by two very impressive American women in the 1930s in 4 years flat in their spare time. So not much seems to have changed. And one of the reasons is because pharmaceutical companies don't invest in vaccines because they're not profitable. They do themselves out of business if they work, a vaccine does. But also, you know, let's just reflect a minute on the World Health Organization here. Its job is to protect us from pandemics. It spends a big chunk of its money, as Chris is the first to point out, on flying its executives around the world and things like that. And when it's not doing that, it tells us that, and this is a direct quote from 2015, the greatest threat to human health in the 21st century is climate change. Well, that may or may not be true, but it certainly implies an agency which is not concentrating on its day job, which is to keep us safe from pandemics. And when the Gates Foundation and the Wellcome Trust set up the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness Innovation in 2017, it's something of a rebuke that no one had thought of doing this before, and it hasn't had time to speed up vaccine development. But you ask the question, can we get enough innovation to get out of this? If you look at the innovation in antiviral drugs that came out of both AIDS and Ebola, it's pretty impressive. And I suspect has given us quite a good platform. So I have a suspicion that we might get treatments for this virus before we get vaccines for it. But either way, we've got a lot of ideas, and it would be pretty disappointing if we couldn't rustle something up quickly. Because one of the things we're learning to do in this pandemic is to cut corners and not take a heck of a long time over regulatory decisions.
And Chris, let me bring you in here. Are you optimistic about, you know, how we're going to tackle this going forward? A lot of those kind of previous barriers to getting things done are starting to move out of the way a little bit.
A little bit, yeah. I don't know about the kind of the path for vaccines so much. You would imagine that there will be a little bit of a corner cutting, perhaps. But I mean, these things always take a long time to produce anyway. I've heard it said that there might be something around in September, which seems very, very soon to me. I agree with Matt. I think we're more likely to see some kind of either a cure or medicines that make it less severe. In fact, we've already got one now, which the NHS is putting out, I think, this week. So, yeah, I'm kind of optimistic that in a real emergency, you will get rid of unnecessary regulation. There's certainly been a lot of that. I mean, moving beyond just the kind of medical and vaccination side of it, there's been a vast amount of deregulation. The American Enterprise Institute have got a website that they are updating on an almost daily basis of all the American laws that have been at least temporarily repealed in order to deal with the coronavirus pandemic. And some of them are fairly trivial, but in a way, that's the point. These things are trivial. So why are they there in the first place? A lot of them relate to alcohol, for example. So many cities and states in America have legalized the curbside sale of alcohol, have legalized home delivery of alcohol, internet sale of alcohol. You know, why were these things not legal in the first place? In Britain, we've legalized pubs delivering food to people. Why was that not legal in the first place? So I'm cautiously optimistic that once some of these laws have been repealed, we might, after the crisis has passed, think, well, is there any real reason to reintroduce them?
Matt, one of the points that you make in your book is that the West has in some respects kind of faltered on the case of innovation in recent years. It's been kind of a little bit partial. You know, we marvel at things going on in Silicon Valley whilst at the same time, you know, traveling on the same kind of transport infrastructure we've had for decades on end. And given the fact that this crisis has really brought I guess, the kind of competition between the West and China into quite sharp relief. Are you confident that this moment will kind of spur us on to recapture that spirit of innovation that you talk about?
I'm not confident that we will, but I think we should. I mean, it seems bizarre to say that we're living through an innovation famine, but if you leave digital innovation out of it, the West has been pretty complacent, pretty precautionary, an excess of precaution about the risks and not thinking about the benefits of innovation, taking it for granted that, you know, our technologies are good enough, we don't need better ones, you know, who needs genetically modified crops? Food seems fine to me. Well, actually, that's a fairly complacent attitude because a lot of crops depend on a lot of chemicals these days. Genetically modified crops would enable us not to depend on chemicals. You need to spray a potato crop about 15 times in a season to keep the fungus down. That's not great for the environment, whereas GMOs could replace that. So there's all sorts of things there. We've also built a whole superstructure of intellectual property that has turned into more of a hindrance than a help to innovation. And we've done so largely at the behest of lobbying by big companies and corporations. And we know from the empirical evidence elsewhere in the world that if you loosen intellectual property rights, you don't find that innovation dries up. And if you tighten them, you don't find that innovation increases. Just look at what happened when Napster came along and it became possible to do streaming of music. Did all the musicians say, right, that's it, I'm never going to write another song? No, they didn't. In fact, the amount of songwriting increased. Sure, they weren't able to sit back and let the royalties roll in from Hey Jude the way they had before. They had to actually go out and do some live performances again, but that's not a bad thing either. So I think there's occupational licensing, there's intellectual property, there's regulation, in particular, sluggish regulation. I don't think it's regulators saying no. It's regulators taking a long time to say yes. Mm. That's often the big obstacle to an innovator. If we were to strip all this away in the wake of this pandemic, then we would be able to get back to rapid growth. And one of the reasons we've had a decade where we can't even manage 2% economic growth is, I think, because we've stifled innovation.
We're going to move on now, I think, to talk a bit more about coronavirus and the lockdown in particular. But the book is called How Innovation Works. I think it's available now in North America, but for pre-order here in the UK. Is that right, Matt?
Yeah, because the difference is that I was able to stop the printing in the UK just in time to write an afterword about coronavirus, but it had already started printing in America, so that wasn't possible. So Brits are going to get a better version of the book on the 25th of June.
The 25th of June, so do go out there and pre-order that. Hi, I hope you're enjoying the episode so far. And if you are, why not take a second to leave us a rating and a review with your podcast provider? It takes just 30 seconds and is a great way to help us reach new people. Now, on with the show. So let's move on to our second topic for today, and probably a permanent topic for some time yet, it seems, and that's the lockdown in the UK. We're 10 weeks into what was originally a three-week lockdown. There's not really any clear end in sight. You know, the government has started to announce some quite cautious easings of restrictions in the past week. But of course, that's been entirely overcrowded by a huge row over Dominic Cummings and whether or not he broke the lockdown rules, a scandal that feels like, if anything, might end up helping to prolong the lockdown. But Chris, before we get into the kind of Cummings circus, which I think we have to, what do you make of this lockdown as we stand here 10 weeks later? You know, is there any real justification for it going on this long?
I certainly don't think the original justification stands, and that's implicitly accepted by the government by the fact that they've removed the term protect the NHS from their slogan. You know, we were sold this way back on the 23rd of March as being something that was necessary to protect the NHS, which is to say necessary to allow anybody who becomes seriously ill with this disease to get reasonable treatment and not die in a hospital corridor. And I think that's understandable. I think that was probably justifiable. But that danger has long since passed, and it's not clear still to me exactly what the government's policy is. I suspect, you know, that really what they're doing is dragging this out for as long as possible because they know they're going to really struggle to do lockdown two. I think that's what it comes down to. So they just want to squash the numbers so far as possible. They're hoping to get this contact tracing technology in place and then hope for the best. But at the moment, the public are so, they're still supportive of the lockdown. Mm. They have no idea really, I don't think, of what kind of economic damage is going to come to the country, and in many cases to them very directly with a redundancy letter in a few weeks' time. The sun's out. They don't have to do any work. They've got their wages covered. And so it's just like the big party on the Titanic.
And Matt, I know that you've become increasingly kind of lockdown skeptic as the weeks have gone on. Is it just that it's run its course, or that it's met its original goals, as Chris was talking about? Or are we starting to think that maybe this kind of measure, this kind of across-the-board blunt instrument approach to this pandemic, wasn't necessarily the right path to begin with?
A bit of both. I mean, like Chris, I certainly had some sympathy at the start for the lockdown. We didn't know enough about the virus. We didn't know how to stop it. We had to try everything we could. But I think one thing that was overlooked by the government and is still being overlooked is that it's much easier to scare people than to unscare them. We've seen that with every other kind of scare in the past decade, as it were. And that actually saying to people, this is terrifying, you've all got to stay at home, was quite easy, actually. Saying, no, get out there, there's nothing wrong with going back to school and going back to work, is much harder. And there are lots of people, as Chris said, there are lots of people who are not happy to be told that it's safe to go out there again. And I hope this isn't true, but I fear that the real reason the government is being so slow to lift the lockdown is because it's looking at these opinion poll numbers. And it thinks that what it's doing is generally popular to keep the lockdown going. I, in retrospect, think that quite early in the epidemic, an entrepreneur who with a medical background named Hugh Osmond said to me, this is a nosocomial epidemic. Most of the people dying of it have underlying conditions, and they're in hospital, and a lot of them were in hospital for other reasons, and this is spreading like wildfire in hospitals. This is where the problem is, because people in hospitals who get it are going to have higher viral loads, they're going to be getting worse doses of it, and so on. And he turns out to be absolutely right. I mean, there's a terrifying map of what happened in a hospital in South Africa when one person from abroad arrived with COVID-19, gave it to one other chap who'd gone in because he had a stroke. He gave it to four other people, one of whom was a nurse who gave it to a whole bunch of other people, etc. And you can actually map the spread of this thing through the hospital. The same with the care homes. That's what we've seen. That's been the fact of the epidemic. And what we've done is we've cocooned the healthy people at home, where they had relatively low risk, particularly if they weren't elderly or had underlying infections, while we've had a burning furnace go through the hospital and healthcare system and social care system. So that feels like the wrong way around. And it feels as if we'd banned large gatherings, told people to keep their distance, encouraged the use of face masks and gloves, insisted on no handshaking and all that kind of stuff, and done a huge amount of testing, like countries like Germany did, in a bottom-up, distributed, decentralized way so that you could get to people as quickly as possible and track down their contacts so as to stop it getting into the hospitals, that would have been far more effective than a blunt instrument of locking down the whole of society. So the extra compulsion of lockdown and destroying the economy, I don't think has added much in terms of healthcare benefits.
Yeah, it does seem odd to me that the government has never seriously tried to do that, to cocoon the elderly. That was kind of the original plan. I mean, way back in kind of late February, early March, I remember people saying that, you know, the vulnerable are going to probably have to be isolated for 12 weeks. And there was never any real attempt to do that. Instead, they're effectively isolated us all for, it would be 12 weeks, definitely, minimum. You know, they're going to extend it this week and that'll be 12, 13 weeks. I think a lot of the blame lies with the bloody behavioral scientists, to be honest with you. If you look at the behavioral science documents published on the kind of SAGE webpage of the government's website, they're incredibly cautious about everything. And they don't seem to base very much of what they say on evidence. It just seems to be gut instinct, really. And behavioral science is not the best of evidence anyway, because a lot of it has kind of been debunked. But it seems to be the case that they just assumed that elderly people wouldn't agree to self-isolation unless the entire rest of society was doing it. They didn't think, to be fair, that people in general would go along with a kind of lockdown that we've ended up with. They were wrong on that. And perhaps they were wrong because they didn't expect the kind of largesse from Rishi Sunak that has actually appeared, admittedly. But it's odd that the obvious thing to do is to protect the vulnerable and allow it to spread basically around the rest of society, which is what Sweden has tried. And, you know, it's not done a great job of protecting the elderly and people in care homes there either. But at least that has been a kind of a coherent strategy. Whereas in Britain, we've just decided to quarantine everybody indefinitely. And it just goes on and on. You know, and the so-called relaxation that we can look forward to in about 3 weeks' time is that the shops are going to open, non-essential shops are going to open. You still won't be allowed to go around someone's house. You still won't be able to go to the pub, of course, which I think is the most important thing. So we're moving out of this really very slowly compared to other countries.
One other thing that I think was badly misread by the epidemiologists and therefore by the behavioral scientists too, was the degree to which this is transmitted by people with few or no symptoms. I think the plan was in mid-March when they stopped testing, remember they said, if you've got symptoms, don't go near anyone. Well, it turned out that wasn't, you know, if you're a nurse and you're in day four of it and you've still got no symptoms, you're going back to work and you were giving it to patients. I think that was a huge misunderstanding. And that was partly based on the fighting the last war. You know, on the whole, flu does show its symptoms pretty early. This thing doesn't. And I think that was quite a big difference.
Before we move into our last section, we should definitely touch on the big story of the, not the day, but the week. It feels like maybe a fair bit longer after this. So Chris, just on the Dominic Cummings case, what are your thoughts? Did he do anything wrong? Is the kind of, you know, level of media and public criticism that has been levelled at him justified in this case?
I think it's for a judge to decide if he's done anything wrong, or for the police to decide. And the police have not pressed charges, they haven't fined him, and he certainly hasn't been convicted of any offence. And I found it remarkable that Emily Maitlis this week started Newsnight by asserting as facts that Dominic Cummings had broken the law. Well, she said broken the rules, but it amounts to the same thing. The rules she's talking about are laws made in late March. And I can't imagine a BBC presenter doing that about anyone else for any other crime. You know, imagine just asserting that somebody has committed rape without them being charged, let alone convicted of it. It just wouldn't happen. I thought it was amazing. I thought it was a really outrageous example of BBC bias. And maybe by the time this podcast comes out, Cummings will have said, yeah, I broke the law, I'm sorry, I resign, or the police would have pressed charges. But that certainly hasn't happened yet. And it hadn't happened when Maitlis decided to tell the world as fact that he had broken the law. I think it's inexcusable.
And Matt, what are your thoughts on this case?
Well, I don't know whether what he did was right or wrong. I do think it was probably unwise. You can see the motivation, certainly. And, you know, I mean, having to, you know, he was very ill. Let's not forget that at one point. And his wife was ill and their four-year-old son was in the house. And to get somewhere near where you've got family, but so many other people would have liked to do something similar and weren't able to go to an aunt's funeral or something like that. And that's where the unwisdom comes in. But when I've seen the piling on, the mob in the street outside his house, the driving up and down the street with a video playing to abuse him, the fact that photographers are not social distancing, that they're writing rude messages on the tarmac in the street. I'm sorry, the more that goes on, the more I hope he stays, because I just think it's completely unacceptable to have mob rule at the best of times. And if we give in to this one, then where does it stop? Any one of us could be sort of savaged into a kangaroo court in this way without due process.
Well, we probably wouldn't be, because we're not Dominic Cummings. And this is about Dominic Cummings. It's a politically driven witch hunt because of who he is. And a lot of people hate him. And they hate him, let's face it, because of Brexit. That's why you've got Anna Soubry and Michael Heseltine, these people coming out of the woodwork on TV to condemn him. And
God, Alistair Campbell. Have they been on TV?
Oh, yes. Yeah. You know, what have these guys got in common? It's so obvious. Admittedly, there are quite a few Tory wets as well who dislike him, largely, I guess, because they think he has so much influence in the government and they think that they themselves should have that influence. Mm-hmm. But it's so obviously politically driven, primarily by Brexit, and the media will not let it go. I'm not convinced that the public is actually all that bothered about it. I certainly wouldn't be that bothered about it if they knew the facts. I mean, the Mirror and the Guardian seem to have lied, for example, when they said that he went up to Durham a second time when he wasn't ill. So the way that the media have managed to drag this out day after day after day, hoping that eventually the government will buckle, which it may do at some point, I don't know, is just so shameless.
Last Orders, like all of Spike's podcasts, is free. There are no subscriptions, bonus episodes for paying customers. We want to reach as many people as possible. But to help us do so, we rely on the generosity of our listeners. So if you enjoy the show and have a bit of money to spare, please do consider making a donation. Anything you can give is greatly appreciated. Now, back to the show. So let's move on to our last topic, kind of on a similarly authoritarian theme, and that is the way in which various countries around the world have used this lockdown, have used this crisis to impose really quite harsh prohibition. So South Africa, India, a number of other countries have banned the sale of alcohol with kind of predictably dire consequences, black markets and deaths from poisonous bootleg alcohol and all the rest of it. So Chris, you wrote an article about this for Spiked. Could you just tell us a little bit more about what's been going on, how this has happened?
Yeah, when I ran the numbers last week and I worked out that in April, one in four people around the world were living under prohibition of alcohol, which has got to be the largest proportion, let alone the largest absolute number ever. And this was largely due to India, which, of course, has a vast population. They banned the sale of alcohol and tobacco during their lockdown. They'd previously last year banned the sale of e-cigarettes and their great unwisdom. But South Africa had done the same thing with both alcohol and tobacco. And quite a lot of countries have banned and continue to ban the sale of alcohol. And some of them have given some fairly lame excuses for why they've done this along the lines of, well, alcohol, if you drink a lot of alcohol, it might affect your immune system, which is, you know, vaguely plausible. In South Africa, they said that if people are out getting drunk, then they're less likely to obey the social distancing rules, which I guess is plausible. I mean, if you ignore the fact that there's actually a legal lockdown and people aren't allowed to leave the house. And, of course, the fact that people in practice have been leaving their house to go meet somebody on a street corner to buy alcohol and tobacco, which isn't great for social distancing. I think it's been really an excuse. The police chief in South Africa has quite openly said that he hopes that the ban on alcohol will remain once coronavirus has gone away. I think the ban on tobacco, which really has no serious foundation, was just because a few people in the government thought that people shouldn't be smoking anyway. Ban on e-cigarettes, similarly. And it's had very predictable effects, as you've alluded to. Yeah, there have been poisonings. Mexico hasn't actually banned alcohol, but for some reason it's banned brewing. And that's led to a real shortage of beer. And my last count was about 200 people have died so far in Mexico from drinking contaminated alcohol. Several people have died in South Africa for the same reasons. And now in South Africa, it's transpired that the ban on cigarettes has actually led to more cases of coronavirus because people are now sharing cigarettes because they're in such short supply. So prohibition has so many weird and wonderful ways of making everything worse. And I guess that's just the latest example.
And Matt, what was your response to this? Were you surprised to read about all of this?
Yeah, I think it's fascinating. And I mean, Chris has written something very interesting in a previous week about how the BBC was interpreting increased home sales of alcohol as a sign that we were all getting drunk. These were replacing sales in pubs. You know, it was, if you can't go to a pub, you might have a glass of wine at home. It doesn't mean we're all turning into alcoholics. I think you can't help seeing, not just in the alcohol and tobacco regs, but also in the whole lockdown phenomenon itself, and indeed in the way people behave towards their neighbors and people on the street, this nightmare of the Puritan that someone somewhere might be enjoying themselves. That's what really gets a lot of people up in the morning.
It's like the people who are going out on beaches enjoying themselves. You know, if you look at these photos, which are always taken from a dodgy angle, in fact, people are at least 2 meters away from each other. People are always at least 2 meters away from each other on a beach. People don't want to be sunbathing that close to anybody else. They're outside in the sunshine, which is probably going to reduce the spread. And it's not like going to a football match or something where you're in the queue for the bar together. You're in a bus or a train going to it in the first place. You're just there outside. You don't talk to other people. You talk to whoever you're with. And that's it. What's the problem? It's just like you say, it's a kind of Puritanism. It's a jealousy at people enjoying themselves, and also a very British approach to rules, which is to, you know, enforce them by the absolute letter and then go beyond that.
Yeah, gold plating. I think there's a bit of that too. But the evidence on transmission is that indoor crowded spaces are the worst, that ventilation makes a huge difference, and so does sunlight. I mean, viruses hate sunlight. That's why they disappear in March and April. And another reason they disappear around then is because people's vitamin D levels go up. And vitamin D definitely helps the immune system fight off these infections. And Brits are, on the whole, vitamin D deficient by the end of winter, particularly those with dark skin, particularly those who are elderly because they don't go outdoors as much, and particularly those who are obese because vitamin D gets sequestrated in fat cells. So getting out and lying on a beach or in a park in the sunshine, where there's extremely little chance of picking up the virus anyway, far less than inside a house, is going to boost your immune system and help you. So I really don't understand why the government doesn't get up and say, look, it's the indoor encounters that are the problem. You're fine if you're outdoors. Just keep your distance and be sensible.
Mm. Chris, it's not been as serious as some of the stuff you were talking about in other parts of the world, but, you know, there has been kind of renewed calls for more kind of nanny state regulation, or at least, you know, a discussion about obesity once it was discovered to be such a big risk factor with COVID. Do you think we are kind of a little bit doomed? I know you were talking a little bit earlier about a lot of the regulations which have been cleared out of the way, but on some of that kind of public health nanny state stuff that you've been talking about for so long, is a lot of that doomed to be kind of continued and kind of ramped up after this?
Yeah, I fear it might well be, because people from the outset were looking for some lifestyle related factor to try and pin this on, because that's just the narrative that we're used to in public health. That's what public health is most of the time in Britain, just nagging people about how many fizzy drinks they're consuming and how much they're drinking. And it failed because we had all this very interesting evidence showing that smokers seem to be rather less susceptible to coronavirus. Alcohol doesn't seem to make any real difference at all. And so they've only been saved by the evidence on obesity. And it is absolutely true that people who certainly are seriously obese, severely obese, they definitely are more at risk. They're about twice as likely to die from it. You know, it's an increased risk, the equivalent of being male, to put it into some kind of context. And then Boris Johnson, of course, came out supposedly with this this notion that he would have been all right had he not been so overweight, and that he's going to go after, you know, the food supply, presumably, I don't know, or encourage people to do more cycling and have a real crackdown on obesity when this is all over. And I dare say he will. The kind of policies are already ready to go. They're oven ready, as Boris would no doubt say, with the whole childhood obesity strategy, which has not yet been implemented. So I suspect that obesity will be used here as a scapegoat. I think the government has every motive to do so as well, because it hasn't handled this well. Let's face it, hasn't handled it at all well. And if it can then pass the blame to the British public for being fat, I guess that would kind of suit them.
Chris, what are the statistics, because I think you've quoted them, about the percentage of the Public Health England's budget that is spent on infectious disease awareness and preparedness compared with nanny statism about diet and lifestyle?
Well, the public health budget is just over £4 billion. And last year, I think £90 million went on sort of preparing for the kind of pandemic that we're now enduring. There is an additional something like 300, maybe even £400 million that goes on routine vaccinations, which falls under Public Health England's remit. So MMR, TB, jabs, they buy all the vaccines in for that and distribute them. But in terms of preparing for the kind of epidemic that we've currently got, it is a very, very small proportion, about 2%. Whereas, to put that in context, about £220 million is spent at least on obesity prevention, and not particularly effectively either.
And Matt, on that, we've talked a little bit about the kind of skewed priorities as well of the WHO and of various different governments. Do you think at least, I mean, it seems like it's not going to be the case, that are we going to see any kind of rebalancing between real public health issues like pandemics rather than a lot of these lifestyle issues that so many people have been obsessed with for so long?
I think we will see some. I think there is no doubt that World Health Organization and others will have to raise the priority of infectious diseases. But the big thing we haven't mentioned here is the role of China. And the influence of China on the World Health Organization has scandalized a lot of people, including me. The moment Donald Trump joined that cause, it was harder to make the case, as is so often the case. But I think people have noticed the degree to which it's a terribly politicized organization. And in that respect, and this is just sort of apropos of nothing in particular, but there has just been published a very interesting study which has finally tracked down some details about the first bat that had this virus. You remember there's this bat called RATG13, which was a genomic sample held in the Wuhan Institute of Virology, and they announced they'd found it in January this year, and that it was very similar to the virus we're catching. And everyone said, okay, well, where did you get it? And tell us more, you know, about this bat, and was the bat ill? And, you know, and we got absolutely no details. Well, two Indian scientists have now tracked down a sample that was taken in that year in the same area, but from a mine shaft, not a cave, and it had always been thought it was in a cave before, and that sequence is in certain key genes absolutely identical. So they're pretty sure that this is the same sample, it's just been renamed. Now, what's interesting about that is that three miners who had reopened this disused mine got sick with a pneumonia-like disease in 2012. And that's why they were looking in that mine shaft. So the Chinese authorities have not been open about where this sample came from and what it tells us. And the Chinese authorities have just admitted that, none of the animals in the seafood market were infected. And we now know that all the early human cases are all very similar. There's no sign of early adaptation to human beings. Mm. So it must have been in humans all along. So the plot is thickening about where this started and why the Chinese have been so unforthcoming, not just with the rest of us, but with the World Health Organization itself. And we do need to know more about this.
Very important point to end on. Matt, Chris, thank you very much for your time. You've been listening to Last Orders. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Please do take a moment to give us a rating and a review. And if you'd like to help support Spiked to keep us making this podcast and all our other podcasts, as well as our daily articles and essays, then please do consider making a donation. It's really easy to do. Just go to spiked-online.com and hit that big red donate button in the top right corner. Anything you can spare is greatly appreciated. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.